Plumeria blossoms filled the cool night air.
I tossed and turned in my bunk, trying to overcome the feeling of homesickness. But the darkness and inactivity of the night only accentuated the longing for the pleasant days of the past. All my good experiences became great ones. Any bad experiences became comical. Girls who were only friends became lovers. Finally, the ache of loneliness lessened, and I fell asleep. A replacement diver. Jimmy's transfer created a need for another diver, so I received permission from Haynes to recruit and train a diver to replace him. We selected Tom Carey, a shipfitter second class. Carey was a strapping 20-year-old with a ready smile and a willingness to work that impressed us. For 2 months he had been hanging around the diving barge after he finished his regular work. He asked questions, observed the repair of equipment, and even helped us clean and store the diving gear for the night. After attending a 3-week diving course at the Pearl Harbor submarine base, Tom Carey was designated a second-class diver. As usual, Ben had something to say about it. "Hope those panty-waist first-class divers over at the escape tank didn't ruin you, Carey. We'll teach you more about diving in 1 week than you'd learn over there in a year." Martin is trapped. The work on the California proceeded on schedule. Our team closed off watertight doors in the compartments adjacent to the torpedo damage in order to isolate any leakage from the patches on the hull. We used oblong wooden patches and strong backs to blank off manholes whose covers were left ajar or had been blown off. Cameron's previous dive was devoted to closing watertight doors and hatches contiguous to the torpedo holes. He had been unable to dog two of the doors closed because the decks and bulkheads in the area were warped from the explosions and fires. It was the last dive of the day, and it was Martin's turn. We sent him down with wedges and a sledgehammer to force the two bulky doors closed. Ben manned the phones and was directing Martin to the site of the doors. Martin reported that he was encountering distorted bulkheads, and in one area the overhead was caved in to such a degree that he had to bend over to get past the damage. He finally reached the forwardmost door he was seeking and managed to force it closed by driving steel wedges under the dogs of the door. As he moved aft to the next door, we heard a thump. "What was that noise, Martin?" Ben asked. "It feels like one of those big ventilation motors. Its fan housing has fallen off the overhead," Martin answered. "It didn't land on me, but it has me trapped in a corner." "Are you hurt? Can you move it?" asked Ben. "No, I'm not hurt, but this weighs a ton. The motor is pressing against my lower body, but I still have some feeling in my legs. Part of the housing is jammed on top of my helmet." Ben had boasted previously that he could move anything with a wrecking bar, so we sent him down with the bar to move the motor. Amid much swearing, huffing, and puffing, Ben was able to move the motor enough to relieve the pressure against Martin's legs. The housing and its attached ventilation line prevented moving the motor sufficiently to completely free him. It was now 10 p.m., and it did not appear that we could extricate Martin before morning. I sent Andy in to notify Pappy of the situation and also to request that he send out an additional air compressor as a backup air supply. Both Haynes and the compressor arrived on the Marianne as we were lowering Bill to try his hand at freeing Martin. Ben seemed to think that if a chain fall was attached to the motor and pulled from the side, both the motor and housing would swing away and free the diver. Bill tried this tactic, but instead of the motor moving out of the way, it rotated and pinned Martin tighter into the corner. Finally, we realized that we had to cut the large ventilation line. Tension was maintained on the motor with the chain fall as Moon severed the line with the arc oxygen cutting torch. The motor and housing tumbled on its side, and we were able to bring Martin to the surface at 4 a.m. Again, it was apparent we had to use trial and error to solve many of the problems we encountered. Explosion on the California. The closure of fittings and the isolation of damaged areas on board the California continued. Most of the residual water had been pumped out. She was readied to move across the harbor and into dry dock. Then a second disaster struck. a violent explosion rocked the bow section of the ship below the third deck level. The blast blew open a hatch on the third deck, allowing water to flood the lower levels. In addition, a large patch covering a 15-foot by 15-foot hole in the bow was blown off by the force of the blast. At first, sabotage was suspected, because in those post-Pearl Harbor days, most military men never quite accepted the fact that resident aliens of Japanese extraction were loyal to their adopted country. Bitter memories of the duplicity and the sneak attack by Japan were too vivid and recent for rational judgments. Resident Japanese in those days were not to be trusted. It was finally concluded that gasoline vapors had accumulated in the space below the third deck from leaking gasoline lines. The spark that set off the explosion came from a short circuit in the temporary lighting system. The explosion opened up the bow section of the California to the sea, and the bow of the ship rapidly sank almost to the bottom of the harbor. Pacific Bridge divers had installed the outside bow patch, so they were called in to locate and retrieve the patch from the bottom. With the help of a floating crane, the patch was brought to the surface. It was badly damaged and bent out of shape from the force of the explosion, and obviously of no further use. The manufacture of another patch would take a week to complete and would disrupt the planned docking schedule for the California. Since docking space for major ships was at a premium, it was essential that the schedules be maintained. Once in dry dock, a salvaged battleship's repairs were planned in such a way that it could be removed from the dock within 72 hours. This policy was necessary to keep the dry docks available for damaged ships of the active fleet fighting the war. Salvage engineers made the decision to isolate the bow damage on the California at the third deck level. This required closing and securing the distorted third deck hatch. The explosion had blown the hatch open and ripped the securing bolts that held the hatch closed from their mountings. The most logical course of action would have been to cut the hinges off the hatch, remove it, and have it straightened by the shipyard shipfitter shop. But this option was not available to us because one of the fleet battleships was damaged and due to arrive for extensive hull repairs, which would tie up the shipfitter shop. Another method of making the hatch watertight was needed. It was decided to arc weld angle iron strongbacks underwater across and above the warped hatch. Then we could drive wedges between the hatch and strongbacks to force the hatch down and make a watertight seal. Our diving team performed this work within a 12-hour period, and the bow of the California was pumped dry below the third deck level. But while Moon and I helped salvage the California, we sacrificed our Saturday date with Hattie and Margaret. Martin was given liberty the next day to attend church, so I asked him to stop by Ernie's and apologize to Hattie for me and tell her I would get in touch later. Meanwhile, the California met her scheduled dry docking date in April 1942. We moved our barges to the USS West Virginia and prepared to start salvage operations.
Chapter 6. USS West Virginia. Fire phenomenon. On the day of the attack, the West Virginia was struck by 7 torpedoes that opened a 300-foot-long hole in her port side. A wall of burning fuel oil from the stricken Arizona surrounded her. The order was given to abandon ship. Tugboats came alongside in a vain attempt to extinguish the flames. They were met with a fire phenomenon not seen before. As the flames were controlled in one area, fire broke out in adjacent spaces. The blaze was not contained for 30 hours, and it caused considerable damage to the interior of the ship. It was later determined that this particular aspect of the fires was caused by burning oil-based paint on one side of a bulkhead, igniting paint on its opposite side. The Navy learned a valuable lesson in the future maintenance of naval ships from this disaster. Warships were stripped of all oil-based paint and repainted with fire-retardant paint. This requirement saved many ships and lives that might otherwise have been lost to the ravages of fire. We get a lesson in diving. Our team began to survey the long gash in the West Virginia's side to determine the best salvage method to raise her.
This preliminary survey would give Pacific Bridge engineers the information needed to plan the type of external patches needed and alert the shipyard to the magnitude of work that lay ahead. "We were getting ready to put the first diver over the side when I spotted Bosun McClung in a boat signaling us that he was coming alongside. Accompanying him was a huge chief petty officer. The two men stepped aboard the barge, and McClung introduced the chief. 'Man, this is Chief Duggs, master deep-sea diver. He was my diving instructor at the deep-sea diving school.' The bosun continued, 'He was one of the heroes from the submarine Squalus salvage job. I requested Washington to transfer him here to give us a hand, since he is an acknowledged salvage expert.' The chief was an enormous man, dwarfing most of us. He was 6 feet 5 inches in height and weighed 275 pounds. There were traces of gray in his brown curly hair, and his face was craggy, deeply tanned and weather-lined, clearly identifying him as a man who had spent much of his life out of doors. The chief will give us the benefit of his expertise, and he will be attached to the salvage unit at the shipyard. He will be directing the efforts to survey the damaged areas on the West Virginia. He'll be responsible for making a sketch of the underwater damage and will then submit it to me. You men have much to learn from the chief about salvage.' So saying, the bosun boarded his boat and headed back to 1010 Dock. The successful salvage effort in raising the sunken submarine Squalus in 1939 was a heralded event throughout the U.S. Navy, and the circumstances of its salvage were known to every diver. Our diving crew felt privileged to have one of its bemedaled heroes on board to give us the benefit of his experience. Chief Petty Officer Willard Duggs spoke in his rich, low voice. 'I'll make the first orientation dive,' he said. I sized him up and asked if a number 3 diving dress would be large enough for him. He answered in the affirmative and directed us to dress him. Bill and Ben got the suit down from the rack, and Doug struggled his bulk into it. He filled every inch. It took both assisting divers to pull the slack up on the suit bib. 'Doggone it, Chief, this dress fits you like a glove,' remarked Bill cheerily. The chief was in no mood for small talk. 'Hurry it up now and get me over to the diving ladder,' he demanded. He was led to the ladder while I manned the telephone. 'Topside, lower me down easy. There's zero visibility down here, and I don't want to get impaled on some wreckage,' ordered the chief. Did he expect searchlights and Benny Goodman down there? And what the hell does impaled mean? Bronco asked. 'It means getting a stanchion jammed up your butt,' Ben answered. 'Ed, tell the chief to use a little more air. He's heavy as 2 tons of S. Bill, give me a hand tending his lines.' 'I'm not going to give the chief any instructions on diving,' I said. 'He's a master diver. He knows what he's doing.' 'Topside, take me up about 4 feet. I'm in the wreckage now,' ordered the chief. 'There, that's good. Now lower me a couple of feet.' The directions kept coming for 90 minutes, though the diver did not progress more than 10 feet in any direction. Ben and Bill were sweating profusely from the exertion of tending the mammoth weight of the chief, and they were muttering obscenities to themselves and each other. 'Topside, take me up another 2 feet. I think I can see something.' This was too much for Ben's temper. With a bellow of rage, he exploded. 'Damn it, Ed, you either tell him to lighten himself up, or I'm going to yell down and tell him to start acting like a diver or get his butt up out of there.' Reluctantly, I gingerly suggested that the chief might want to lighten his weight by inflating his suit. 'Topside,' came the answer, loud and clear. 'When I want your advice, I'll ask for it. Now take me up about 4 feet so I can clear this wreckage.' We all wondered how long this could continue. The chief had been down 2 hours, and Ben commented that he had never given any estimate of damage. He figured this was the longest orientation dive in history. 'Be patient,' Moon said. 'He'll have to pee pretty soon, then he'll surface.' 'Knock it off, you guys,' I said. 'He may not be able to teach us anything about handling ourselves underwater, but he did play a key role in salvaging the Squalus in his younger days.' 'Yeah, and remember, he taught Bosun McClung everything he knows about diving,' Mullen added sarcastically, recalling the bosun's one and only dive on the Utah. He was probably a pretty good diver in his day, I said, trying to make a case for the chief. He's not a kid anymore, probably 35 years old. Bill said there was an old Kanaka shipyard diver who was old enough to be his father, and he was still diving. He maintained the chief had been sitting around the diving school drinking coffee for so long, he had forgotten how to dive. To Ben's relief, the chief finally gave a signal on his lines to bring him to the surface. Dougs laboriously climbed the diving ladder, stumbled over to the dressing stool, and sat down wearily. Ben and Bill removed his helmet and breastplate as he sat hunched, breathing heavily. "I think I may have had an accident," he said finally, eyes directed off into space. "I haven't done that since the Squalus job." "That can happen to anyone after a 3 or 4 hour dive," I broke in quickly, hoping to head off any snide remarks from Ben. "There's a bucket of soapy water and a brush you can use to scrub out your suit, and a barrel of fresh water to rinse out your diving underwear." "What did you find down there, Chief?" Moon asked, trying to sound serious and keep a straight face. Dougs just shook his head and mumbled that there was a hell of a lot of wreckage. During a 2 and 1/2 hour dive, Chief Dougs discovered the great difference between diving on an undamaged submarine and working on a torpedoed, sunken battleship. The plan to raise the West Virginia. During the following 4 days, our diving team surveyed the entire port side of the West Virginia and plotted the damaged areas on the ship's plan. Chief Dougs was not seen again aboard the diving barge. We surmised that, like Bosun McClung, he had found the administrative duties at the yard salvage office more to his liking. This was disappointing to Ben. He had few other people he could make light of in the intervening months of arduous work. In addition to the huge gouge in her side, the survey showed that a torpedo had exploded in the steering engine room and had torn the rudder off. The rudder was located lying in the mud, and a line was attached to it with a buoy to mark its location for future recovery. Raising the West Virginia would be far more difficult than either the Nevada or California had been. It would test the ingenuity and salvage expertise of every faction involved in the operation. Based on the results of the survey, a salvage plan was developed to raise the ship. We planned to construct and install a huge cofferdam over 300 feet long, which would cover the torpedo holes. We would pour 650 tons of underwater cement to seal its sides and bottom. We would then open all doors and hatches to allow the trapped water to flow down to its lowest level, where it could be pumped out. Next, we would reestablish watertight integrity throughout the ship by closing all openings we had previously opened, thereby isolating the damaged areas. As the ship was refloated, all weights would be removed as they became accessible. Civilian Pacific Bridge contract divers were assigned the outside job of attaching the enormous cofferdam patches to the hull over the torpedo holes. Our diving crew was given the task of opening and closing watertight fittings and repairing closures within the ship. We had slowly worked our way up to the third deck level, closing all watertight openings as we went. Although it was thought there were approximately 66 bodies within the West Virginia, we had not found any as yet. That was soon to change. Tony was the scheduled diver. He lowered himself down to the third deck. Martin was on the telephone, and he had directed the diver to the watertight door at frame 55. "Topside, I'm here at the door, ready to undog it, but there is a body wedged in the top part of it, and I can't budge him." This was Tony's first encounter with a corpse underwater. He was trying not to show his uneasiness, but most of our crew had experienced anxiety in dealing with the dead men in the darkness, and we understood his nervousness. "Feel around his body. His belt must be caught on one of the door bolts," Martin suggested. Tony struggled with the mass and said the body seemed to be clear of any obstruction, but he couldn't pull him away from the door. "Well, grab him by one of his arms or legs and pull him away." It was obvious that Tony was having a bad time coping with this situation. Martin asked me to take the phones. He said he thought I might handle the communication better. Tony was mumbling under his breath, beseeching the cadaver to come free. All at once his voice became a sharp cry. "Oh, God! I just pulled his arm off. What should I do with it?" In a measured tone, I said, "Just drop the arm where you're standing. When the water is pumped out, they can put it and his other parts in a bag and bury him just like the others. Is the body free now?" He said it was. He was calmer at that point, but said he felt sick with revulsion. "I know how you feel, but you'll run into more of those poor guys before you're through. You'll never get used to it, but it won't be quite as bad next time," I said, remembering my own first experience on the Arizona. Things proceeded smoothly until a 3-day delay halted diving inside the ship until cofferdam patches were manufactured. When the cofferdam patches were ready to be secured to the hull, it was my turn to dive. I started my dive on the first platform deck level to establish an area of watertight integrity. This proved impossible because there was so much damage that all the road marks were wiped out. I could not identify or determine what remained in that part of the ship. We solved this problem by establishing a boundary nearer the center line of the ship, where the damage was minimal and water tightness could be achieved. We soon learned that when we thought everything was under control, something was sure to change it. Bill began a new survey near amidships, and his route was being duly recorded by topside. He had just finished saying that he was stepping through the door at frame 97 when he screamed into his phone that he was falling. His phone faded in and out intermittently, but his last transmission was loud and clear. "Something is wrong with my air supply." We were not able to get an answering pull on his lines, so we knew they were hung up somewhere. Moon was hurriedly dressed and sent down to follow his lines. We tried to contact Bill, but we could not get through. In a matter of minutes, Moon reached the watertight door Bill had fallen through. He reported that Bill stepped into a compartment where the deck had been blown away by a torpedo. He found Bill, a little dazed from his 20-foot fall, lying in the midst of shards of decking, but none the worse for wear. Later, Moon said he could not understand how Bill was not impaled on some of the wreckage. "God must love all dumbheads," Moon teased. Bill's air hose was slashed, and the air was leaking from it. The telephone wires in his lifeline were also nicked, which had caused the lapses in communication. Divers are persona non grata. "Hey, Eddie, my boy, let's take advantage of the next couple of days off and go over to Hattie's house." Moon was putting his freshly laundered whites in the footlocker at the foot of his bunk. "Margaret told Martin to tell me she borrowed 2 quarts of bourbon from the restaurant storeroom so we can have a few shooters on Ernie. Apparently Ernie stashed it away before Prohibition." It sounded like a fine idea to me, so we decided to ride into town the next day and arrange a date with the girls. Ernie's was filled to capacity with a sea of white Navy uniforms and a sprinkling of Army khaki. As usual, the enormous figure of the owner could be seen sitting at the front door on his bar stool, regulating the number of patrons permitted to enter. We saw Hattie and Margaret serving customers behind the bar. Our turn finally came, and we were motioned to a table. We ordered steaks, and when Hattie took her break, she joined us. "Do you want something to eat?" I asked her. "No, thanks," she said. "I've got a tooth that's killing me. It's an abscessed wisdom tooth. I can't get an appointment with a dentist till Monday, and I'm having a hell of a time with it." She said her dentist told her that she, like many Hawaiians, would probably lose her teeth before age 50 because she did not drink enough milk, and the water supply lacked the necessary minerals to build strong teeth. Moon thought that was a rather grim prediction and joked about it being another reason to end Prohibition, which was still in effect on the island. I told her we had the weekend off, but we would certainly understand if she didn't want to party. "I'm not going to let a toothache keep me from partying," she declared. "The only time I feel good is after I have a few drinks. Plan on Saturday. Margaret's off work at 5, and she's got some good whiskey for us." Moon and I took our time and arrived at Margaret and Hattie's small frame house at 6 p.m. The house was raised on concrete pilings to protect it from Oahu's heavy rainfall and numerous insects. Both girls were in a jovial mood. Hattie broiled the island's famous ono, or wahoo fish, using a highly seasoned Portuguese recipe. The fish and fresh salad and bread were delicious. As we were finishing the home-cooked food, a sudden shower dropped rain on the corrugated tin roof, making conversation difficult. Moon helped Margaret with the dishes as Hattie and I settled on the rattan couch in the small living room. "How is the tooth?" I asked sympathetically. "Not so bad now that I've had a few drinks. I may not even go to the dentist," she declared defiantly, helping herself to another generous glassful of Jack Daniels. Moon and Margaret joined us, and we sat around chatting comfortably as the second bottle was opened. "So we're drinking courtesy of old Ernie, eh?" Moon was savoring the smooth liquid, so different from the harsh alcohol we had provided. "Hell no," Margaret replied. "This is just a small payment for all the crap he passes out after I tell him to keep his paws off me." "Why don't you quit if he gives you such a bad time?" "Tips are too good to give up. And besides, all my friends work there. We're the only place in town with such high-class employees, all Portugooses," she giggled. "Let's drink to fat old Ernie." Hattie slopped more of the whiskey in everyone's glass and held hers high. "Here's to his generosity and his ugly face." Her words were slurred, and she laughed shrilly as she leaned her head on my shoulder. "I think you girls are ahead of us in the drinking department," I laughed. "I only drink for medicinal purposes," hiccuped Hattie, "and I just hope we don't run out of medicine before I'm cured." "Speaking of medicine, that island beer has got to be the worst taste in stuff I ever drank," I said. "Spad, all right. I suspect they brew it with dog ass and sewer water. Don't know how you poor guys were able to sit at the bar and sop it up all day long." Margaret shook her head sadly. "I sure as hell hope that brewery goes out of business before Prohibition is over," Moon said. We finished off the bottle and Hattie yawned. "Honey, I gotta get up early tomorrow. It's time you help me into my little old bed." Moon was happily covering Margaret with noisy, wet kisses, and she finally shoved him away. "Sorry, Moon baby, but you ain't going to get nothing tonight. Old Margaret's got her monthly." Not to be discouraged, he announced, "Well, darling, there's other ways to satisfy this Irishman." She struggled to her feet and looked down into his hopeful face. "Save that crap for those whores on Hotel Street," she shouted at him, eyes flashing. "Okay, okay, don't get so huffy. We'll go to bed and just snuggle, all right, baby?" She flounced out of the room, and he followed her into the small bedroom. After they left, Hattie and I staggered unsteadily down the hallway into her room. Hattie lay close in my arms, her full round curves pressed against me. She was breathing heavily in her passion, and the halitosis from her abscessed tooth drifted into my face. While the large amount of Jack Daniels I had consumed made me immune to the lumpy mattress and the hot, muggy night, I could not concentrate on making love to this girl with her bad breath. I considered my options. I didn't want to hurt her feelings or disappoint her, but the situation rendered me incapable of making love. If I pretended to pass out from too much booze, she might leave me alone and turn over. But I wasn't sure I could fake unconsciousness. I finally decided that if I held my breath while I kissed her and pressed my nose against her cheek during the sex act, maybe I could perform the job expected of me. While contemplating this plan, my partner's body grew more and more relaxed, and I realized that she had drifted off to sleep and was snoring sonorously. I was hungry for a cigarette and moved into the living room looking for my lighter. I saw the shadowy figure of Moon sitting dejectedly in one of the armchairs. "Is Hattie out of commission, too?" "No, she's asleep, thank goodness. I couldn't stand her breath another second." Moon asked what I was planning to do. I told him I was getting out of the house pronto before Hattie woke up. I planned to hide in the thick shrubbery near the back of the house until daylight and then hightail it back to the base. It would not be the best way to spend my liberty night, but I didn't want to be caught violating the curfew between 9 p.m. and sunrise. In a drunken, befuddled voice, Moon asked me if I'd mind if he sneaked into Hattie's bed while she was asleep. "She'd never know I wasn't you in the dark," he said. I told him he was crazy as hell. She would know who he was in a second. I warned him not to try it. I got dressed and left the house. I huddled outside in the bushes to avoid the cruising shore patrol and the Honolulu police patrols. I had just settled into a fairly comfortable spot in the shrubbery when I heard Hattie's blood-curdling scream and a stream of profanities. Margaret was awakened, and I cringed as I heard both the girls yelling at the top of their voices, accusing Moon of every crime ever committed against women, except perhaps that of robbing Hattie of her virginity. Moon was trying his best to make a joke of his evil deed, but neither girl was buying his story. Hattie's last words emphasized that she never wanted to see him or me ever again, and she was very explicit about what each of us could do with our body parts. Moon staggered out the front door in his skivvies, carrying his folded uniform in his hands. He found his way to the back of the house, peering in the bushes and whispering my name. When I first heard the commotion inside the house, I was afraid the neighbors would call the police, thinking a murder was being committed. But when I pictured what was taking place inside, I started laughing and couldn't stop. "Is that you, Ed?" Moon asked, parting the shrubbery. "Yes, you dumb clown. Get dressed and climb in here before the cops grab you." "Guess I messed up royally with the girls," he sighed remorsefully. "No more beach parties or anything." He looked so pathetic I told him to forget it. "I should have dragged you out when I left the house," I said. "Besides, if my flight training doesn't come through, I'm getting off this rock some other way." "If you go, I'm going too, buddy," Moon declared, and he gave me a comradely punch on the shoulder just before he fell backward into the shrubbery. So ended the relationship between our diving crew and the lively Portuguese women. Our disappointment was twofold, since we could not enjoy another steak at Ernie's, fearful of having to face the embarrassing recriminations we were sure would be forthcoming from Hattie and Margaret. Tragic deaths. As soon as the two main patches on the port side of the West Virginia were made reasonably watertight, the water level within the ship and the cofferdam patches was reduced 5 feet, but at that point the inflow of water equaled the pumping capacity, and no further headway was made in dewatering. Most of the leakage was found to occur in the areas contiguous to the patches from leaking seams, shrapnel holes, and loose rivets. The leaking seams were repaired using underwater arc welding, while the larger shrapnel holes were plugged using wooden patches drawn up tight against the hull with J-bolts. Smaller holes and loose rivets were made watertight by driving wooden plugs into them. After 5 days of continuous work patching leaks, the pumps were able to overcome the ingress of water, and the West Virginia was refloated. However, problems related to lightening her load were far from over. Originally, Dry Dock No. 2 was designated for docking the West Virginia because her docking sill was 40 feet deep. However, the No. 2 dry dock was reserved for the repair of major fighting ships, especially aircraft carriers, that might sustain combat damage. This precluded its use for the battleship, leaving only the much smaller No. 1 dry dock with its 36-foot deep sill. As dewatering continued, the ship rose higher and higher. Work crews from the ship's force and the salvage and repair unit began unloading oil, ammunition, and stores from the accessible areas. In addition, 66 bodies in an advanced state of decomposition were recovered and placed in canvas bags for burial. 3 bodies were found in a completely dry storeroom. They were dressed in blue uniforms. The 3 had emergency rations stored at their battle station, and they had ample water, since they had removed the cover to an adjacent freshwater tank. They also had battle lanterns available for their use. 2 of the men wore wristwatches, and 1 of them carried a wallet-sized calendar, which had the days checked off from 7 December to 23 December. It was believed their deaths were due to lack of oxygen. The discovery of these 3 men in an unflooded compartment caused a profound sense of anguish among our divers. Especially shaken were Moon and Tony, who had sounded the West Virginia's hull on 12 December and reported no response from within the ship. Both divers were positive there were no answering sounds from their hammering on the hull. The Tennessee was jammed up against the West Virginia's starboard side so tightly that nothing could slip between them. It had been impossible to sound that area. They had sounded the damaged port side, but there was so much wreckage jutting out that the sounds of their hammering probably were not transmitted through the hull. I sensed that Moon and Tony were suffering from guilt feelings that were unjustified. I assured them that they had done everything humanly possible to find the trapped men. The fact that they had been imprisoned in that particular location was a cruel twist of fate. In any event, it's extremely improbable that we could have rescued them, even if we had known they were there, I said. I'm no engineer, but given the depth of water over the battle station's access hatch, there must have been tons of water pressure on top of it. Neither the men inside pushing up on it, nor the divers pulling, could have opened it. So let's forget the guilt trip. We did our best to find all the men. We might have saved them if we had had our underwater arc-cutting torch in those early days. We could have punched a hole in the top of the compartment and allowed water to flood the space, Moon said thoughtfully. When the water level got high enough and the water pressure inside and outside were equalized, the men could have undogged the hatch and opened it. For crying out loud, that rescue scenario has got so many holes in it and so many ifs and maybes, it's ridiculous. The fact is, we didn't have the cutting torch, and even if we had, we probably would have killed them with the fumes from the burning red lead paint. The men are gone. There wasn't anything we could have done about it, I stated firmly. I know you're right, Ed, but I feel lousy, Tony said. I was the one that sounded the hull. He walked slowly away to the end of the barracks, where his bunk was located. I watched him as he lay prone on his bed, eyes staring at the ceiling, and I realized he was far more affected by this situation than I would have believed. He had always been such a loner, someone that none of us could reach, and one who rarely showed emotion. This incident brought out a quality I had not seen before. He seemed devastated by his feelings of guilt and grief, and it was many days before he seemed free of those feelings. Diving Seabees. During the first few months after Pearl Harbor was attacked, Navy divers received the sum of $10 a month in additional diving pay. Congress finally recognized the hazards involved in wartime diving, and we began to earn $5 per hour, or any portion thereof, for dives certified to be extremely hazardous. Dives in and around sunken ships were deemed to meet this criterion. While the pay was still less than that of the Civil Service and Pacific Bridge Divers' pay scales, it was nevertheless a vast improvement, and morale soared. On average, our divers earned $10 to $20 a day in extra pay. I was making as much money as a full commander in the Navy. Shortly before the West Virginia was ready for dry docking, two CB sailors, Matt Wiley and Roscoe Cole, were sent by their unit to be trained as salvage divers. Both men were in their mid-30s and had been journeyman steelworkers in civilian life. They attended second-class diving school and in a very short time handled themselves well underwater. They proved within the first month to be valuable additions to our diving crew on the West Virginia. The day following their first payday as salvage divers, they showed up on the barge with long faces. "What's the matter, Roscoe? You look like you lost your best friend," I said. "No, but we're out of a good-paying job. The old man is recalling us from temporary duty," Roscoe lamented. "Is your outfit pulling out?" "Hell no. According to our disbursing officer, the skipper asked to see our pay records after a month's diving pay had been entered. When he saw how much we earned, he blew his stack. He said we were making more dough than he was as a lieutenant commander." "Doesn't he know that you're risking your neck for that extra dough?" Moon asked. "Damn it, we need you guys. We'll be short-handed without you, and that means we'll just have to train somebody else. I'm going to talk to Haynes. Maybe he can scotch your recall," I said. After I explained the situation, Haynes called the office of the CB's commanding officer. "Commander Larder, this is Commander Haynes, diving officer of the salvage unit. I'm calling regarding your command's recall of two of your divers, Wiley and Cole." I listened attentively as Haynes used his buttering-up technique on the other officer. I wondered if it would be effective in charming the CB officer out of his men. "Well, Commander, I can appreciate that you need their services, but we need them desperately here. We are on the front line, so to speak. It's vital that we get these ships raised and back with the fighting fleet," Haynes said. There was a short pause as Haynes's brow creased into a frown, and he listened impatiently to the man on the other end of the line. "No, I'm not saying your unit isn't important, too, but it's more a question of work priorities. Don't you agree? If you could just spare them until we get the West Virginia in dry dock, I'd truly appreciate it." His voice became more strident as the frown increased. "Not even for that short period? Is that your final decision, Mr. Larder?" He drew out the Mr., and he scowled as he drummed his fingers impatiently on the desktop. "Damn it, Larder, that is the flimsiest excuse for recalling those men I ever heard. You and I both know that's a bunch of crap." He was yelling now, and he smacked his fist on the desk. He looked over at me, suddenly aware that his conversation was being monitored, so he quickly motioned me out the door. As I exited, I overheard the angry voice of Haynes. "And one more thing, Larder, you can damn well take your excuses and jam." I returned to the diving barge and related the heated telephone exchange to the team. "Well, I'll be damned," said Ben in amazement. "You mean to tell me Pappy got all over another officer to help out an enlisted man?" "I wonder if he'll get himself in trouble insulting that CBCO," Martin asked. "Are you kidding, Martin?" I said. "Pappy was an officer before Columbus discovered America. He's plenty senior to that miserable CB officer. He may not be able to keep Wiley and Cole on the diving crew, but I sure gotta give the old buzzard credit for trying." After this experience with the petty jealousies of an outside command, only volunteer divers from the salvage and repair unit were selected and trained. A tremendous amount of salvage work still remained to be accomplished on Oklahoma. Therefore, an additional 10 Navy divers were accepted and joined the diving crews. Prohibition rescinded. A few weeks later, on a Saturday, Pappy Haynes sent for me as the team arrived for work. He informed me that since our work on the West Virginia was completed, he wanted me to move the diving barge to the Oklahoma on Monday. He wanted the crew to start cutting into the magazines and removing the 5-inch shells. He also told me the salvage engineers planned to leave the 14-inch shells on board as ballast during the righting phase. He finished his instructions with an unexpected surprise. "Tell the men to take the weekend off." I hurried off to tell the guys about weekend liberty, but the prospects of liberty without the company of feminine companions produced scowls and gripes, all targeted toward Moon and his misbehavior. They couldn't look forward to a steak at Ernie's, our alcohol supply was depleted, and the island brew was so lousy they wouldn't consider going into town for a drink of it. We spent Saturday morning lounging around the barracks, reading books or writing letters. Moon said he was tired of his grumbling companions, so he walked over to the administration building to visit a friend. Noon chow went down, and we ambled listlessly over to the mess hall, went through the chow line, then sat dejectedly eating the tasteless food. As we were finishing, Moon burst through the door and bounded over to our table. We didn't even bother to look up. "I got great news, you guys," he said eagerly. "Yeah? You shipping out to Tokyo?" Ben asked. He finally got our attention when he announced that he had it on good authority that the U.S. Army had just rescinded their prohibition order for Hawaii. This meant we could finally get a decent mixed drink in a Honolulu bar. It didn't take us long to return to the barracks, don our uniforms, and head for Honolulu and Waikiki. Ben, lover extraordinaire. Sunday night found a barracks full of men nursing hangovers and lamenting the fact that while booze was plentiful, women were not. In fact, the end of Prohibition had caused the few available women to become even more cautious about appearing on the streets of Honolulu, and no one could really blame them. We were casting off the lines to the sampan on Monday morning when Haynes arrived on the pier, face flushed and out of breath. He said plans had changed for the Oklahoma's salvage. Recent soundings of the harbor bottom around the exterior of the battleship revealed that the amidship section was resting on solid coral, but the bow was partially afloat in soft mud. It was believed the mud would allow the bow to slide rather than rotate during the righting operation. They needed to deposit thousands of cubic yards of coral under the bow area. a pile of crushed coral 1/3 of a mile long, 1/3 of a mile wide, and 1/3 of a mile high was moved under the bow for support. Since our diving barges would be in the way of this work, Pappy told me to leave the barges tied up to the West Virginia. He ordered us to perform progressive maintenance on our equipment for the next 2 weeks. After a few days of the very dull but necessary chores of repairing torn diving dresses, assembling new lifelines and air hoses, and replacing parts of damaged equipment, the crew became restive. Moon, who somehow managed to get information from sources all over the base, told us that the Royal Hawaiian Hotel was not completely occupied at the present time. The guys asked me to approach Pappy Haynes and request his help in getting us some R&R at the hotel. Haynes told me he would check out the possibility with one of his contacts, but he said not to count on it. Heretofore, the only men allowed to use the hotel were aviators and submariners who had been in combat or who had finished a war patrol. So we felt privileged when a day later, Pappy informed us that we had reserved rooms at the famous Pink Hotel in Waikiki. Andy, Ben, Carrie, and I were the first to go, and we were assigned single rooms. Each room was furnished with a double bed, a large dresser, and 2 easy chairs. Andy was content to bask on the beach and compose letters to Enid, his girl in the Midwest. Carrie, on the other hand, explored the wonders of tidal pools and hiked up the crater of Diamond Head until the army caught him one day and drove him off. Ben spent most of his waking hours prowling the bars of Waikiki, looking for his favorite type of women, those with big hooters and broad rears, but without much luck. I spent much of my time in the lovely hotel, hoping to find a higher class of female companionship, also without much luck. It had been a dull and relaxing 6 days, but our stay was nearly over since this was our last evening. Ben wanted a good Chinese dinner and asked me to join him. I wanted to refuse his invitation, but he looked so forlorn I decided to go along. The two of us headed for the famous Chinese restaurant Lao Yi Choi, more commonly nicknamed Lousy Chows, by the military. Ben and I sat in the bar waiting to be seated when a tall sailor, too thin for his height, came up behind Ben and slapped him on the shoulder. "Hey, you tub of lard, how the hell you been?" the sailor asked. Ben introduced me to his old friend Joe. I sat there and laughed at their sea stories and humorous reminiscences. They had been stationed together on the USS Medusa. Joe was in mid-sentence when he glanced up and stopped abruptly, his eyes wide. "Ben," Joe whispered, "don't fall off your stool. But a couple of beauties just came in the front door. They don't have nobody with them, and if we hurry over there, maybe we can buy them a drink." We watched closely as the two women walked to the bar and sat down. One was a tall blonde wearing a green jersey dress that emphasized her bony frame. A severe overbite made it difficult for her to close her lips tightly. Her large teeth dominated her thin face. Her friend was much shorter and heavier. As she swiveled around on the bar stool, I noticed that her generous derriere covered and overlapped the leather seat. She wore a very large picture hat of black straw, decorated with multicolored artificial flowers clustered on the underside of the brim. This giant masterpiece of millinery diminished the small white face, which had a red Cupid's bow painted on it. "Which one looks good to you, Ed?" Joe asked. "It's your pick. Ben and me don't care which one we get, we can always share her." "I appreciate your generosity, guys, but count me out. I'm going to hit the sack early." "Well, I'm partial to blondes," Joe said. "I'll take the tall one with the yellow hair."
"Good God," Ben whispered to me. "Times is tough. I never thought anything like them two would ever look good to me. I'm glad Joe wants the blonde. With that set of choppers, she could chew corn cobs through a picket fence."
Ben got to his feet as Joe declared he would engage the two cuties in sparkling conversation.
"You're a smooth talker, all right," said Ben, eyes rolling skyward, "but if I let you do the talking, we'll both miss out for sure."
As the two sailors approached the women, I moved to an empty table within earshot, anxious to observe this encounter. It went something like this.
"Hi, girls," Ben started, smiling his brightest smile. "My buddy Joe and me been admiring you ladies, and we wondered if we could buy you a drink."
"That's nice of you boys. I'll have a gin and tonic," answered the blonde in a low, husky voice. "And I'll have bourbon on the rocks," piped the lady in the hat, her tiny lips parting into a smile as she squinted myopically at the two sailors. Things seemed to be going very well. "I'm Ben, and this here's Joe. And what might your names be?" said Jolly Ben. "I'm Thelma," the blonde answered, baring her large teeth further with a smile. "And I'm Mimi," said the hat. "Pleasure to meet you." Joe entered the conversation as he slid up on the bar stool next to Thelma. "Where are you girls from?" asked Ben, taking the empty seat beside Mimi. "We don't see lovely ladies like you by themselves very often." The two girls basked happily in the warmth of Ben's compliment. "We live inland up near Schofield. Both our husbands were ordered out to Midway Island last month," answered Mimi, her eyebrows dipping in a forlorn little frown, an obvious attempt at expressing her sadness. "Geez, that's too bad. Guess it gets pretty lonely out there without a husband," Ben sighed sympathetically. "Yeah, and if we tried to take a little break like this around there, some nosy witch would be sure to start nasty rumors about us," Mimi said. "And we're not the kind of wives who would..." "You got that right, Mimi," sniffed Thelma. "Every time we meet up with some dog faces, the first thing they want to do after they buy us a drink is to get us into bed, and we just ain't those kinds of girls." "Hell no, you ain't. It's easy to see that. If you were, Joe and me wouldn't want nothing to do with you. We're looking for a couple of nice girls to spend a pleasant evening with, right, Joe?" Joe nodded enthusiastically. The girls consumed four more drinks in short order, and I noticed Mimi was slurring her words and giggling uncontrollably at everything Ben said. "What say we all go over to the Royal Hawaiian and dance?" Joe suggested. "That's a great idea, honey," Thelma replied. "I'd go for that, Benny," Mimi said. "But I heard that's just for R&R, and they probably won't let us in." "I got a surprise for you, little lady. I'm staying there," Ben declared triumphantly, "and I can take anybody in there I want." The girls smiled happily. "Are the rooms as pretty as we've heard?" Mimi asked. "Can we take a peek at your room?" Thelma smiled coyly. "Hell yes," Ben beamed. "As a matter of fact, we can even have a drink up there. I've got a full bottle of Jack Daniels just waiting to be opened." "Oh, goody. I'd rather drink than dance any old day," Mimi giggled. As Ben walked past my table, he leaned over and asked me if I wanted to have a nightcap with them. I declined, knowing that a fifth wheel might hamper this romance. I told him I would follow them to the hotel, but I'd keep a discreet distance away. I said I would meet him for breakfast in the morning and would expect a full report of his conquest. The two couples wended their way through the garden to the front entrance of the hotel. Ben raised his hand and stopped them. I hid behind a tree, waiting for them to enter the hotel. The last thing I heard from the group made me smile. "Joe and me will go in the front way and open my room. You two girls wait outside the emergency exit door until I come and let you in. That way, nobody'll see you and get the wrong idea." I was finishing my second cup of coffee the next morning when a bleary-eyed Ben arrived and sank into his chair with a deep sigh. "Don't tell me the hat was too much for you, Benny boy. You look like she put you through a ringer." "You wouldn't believe what happened last night." Ben launched into the story of his romance with the hat. Ben said he and Joe got the two girls safely into room 107. They broke open a bottle of whiskey and each had a few snorts. The girls asked if the workbench was comfortable and then proceeded to try it out by bouncing up and down on the double bed. He said Joe and the girls used the bathroom and then it was his turn. When he finished, he flicked off the light and opened the bathroom door. The room was dark except for a glimmer of light showing through the transom over the door, providing just enough illumination to make out the figures in the bed. Joe had mounted Thelma and was banging away solidly. The bed springs were squeaking, and the two participants were breathing heavily. Thelma's raucous voice cried out noisily from time to time. Ben tiptoed over to the far side of the double bed and slipped out of his skivvies. He pulled back the sheet and fell into the arms of an eager, amorous Mimi. Mimi grabbed him, and he entered her ample body. His mouth met hers in a long, passionate kiss. Then, as the lovemaking progressed, he pressed his left cheek affectionately against hers and felt his nose grating against a coarse, textured fabric. He thought a classy hotel like the Royal Hawaiian would have a better grade of linen. Shifting his head to the other side of her face, he continued humping happily. Ben was near climax when he realized his nose was breathing noisily into a wad of rough material. "What the hell is this?" he wondered vaguely, as he worked steadily on Mimi, completing the act. Ben and Joe finished their lovemaking at about the same time, and find